In the matter of Players Place 2 Condominium Association versus KP and BF, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. David Byrne, Ann Silverman, and Aaron on behalf of the Players Place 2 Condominium Association.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Now, Craig, the firm of Bill, and Craig, on behalf of KP and BF. With me today is my partner, Donna Cadell, who I've approved of all of the committees. Good afternoon,
welcome, counsel. I wanted to tell you what I hope is obvious. We line up two cases because if somebody's out for the first one, we need something to fill the time, and it took up 2 hours of your time. I appreciate that. Mr. Byrne.
Thank
years through trial, defendant's dishonesty worsened, leaving the trial court with little choice but to conclude, in essence, about defendants, I cannot believe you. When it comes to possible non-observable disabilities, as opposed to one's blindness or wheelchair confinement, for example, a resident's veracity, sincerity, and credibility must be of paramount importance. The most brazen a resident's dishonesty, the more impossible it will be for a fact finder to determine whether a resident's desired accommodation is necessary for the purposes of LAD, which is exactly what happened here. No one disagrees that in order to get a housing provider's accommodation in its rules, practices, policies, and services, the resident should have to prove by preponderance of the evidence that one, she is disabled for purposes of LAD, and two, that the precise accommodation sought is necessary to afford her equal use and enjoyment of the dwelling. The latter should involve proof of a direct link between the proposed accommodation and the equal opportunity. The Third Circuit, I think, wrote it best. If the proposed accommodation provides no direct amelioration of a disability's effect, it cannot be said to be necessary. Everyone agrees, I think, that that's how courts should adjudicate these disputes. The association advocated for that at all levels of this case. And obviously, a fact finder's determination of necessary has to involve an incredibly fact-sensitive examination. Defendants and the Attorney General correctly say that a desired accommodation might be necessary, even if a mental health professional has not prescribed or even recommended it. However, the trial court did not find that the dog was not necessary because no one prescribed or recommended it. Rather, the trial court found the dog was not necessary because, in part, defendants lied when they said a mental health professional prescribed and or recommended it. BF testified and swore via interrogatory answers that the dog was prescribed by mental health professionals. However, BF's therapist testified that she never recommended, suggested, or prescribed any animal, let alone BF's 70-plus pound dog. In fact, BF's therapist told the trial court that she did not even learn about the dog until after it was adopted. Similarly, BF's psychiatric nurse practitioner testified that she never prescribed, recommended, or suggested any animal. So again, the trial court did not incorrectly decide that the dog wasn't necessary because it wasn't prescribed by a mental health professional. No, the trial court decided that the dog wasn't necessary because defendants lied when they said that it was. Defendants' brazen dishonesty was so crucial to the courts below because defendants were literally the only witnesses who concluded that the dog had any ameliorative effect on BF's mental health at all. Dr. Cannon never actually concluded that the dog ameliorated any aspect of BF's condition. All she did was repeat that defendants concluded it. In essence, she was a well-compensated stenographer. She met with them together one time for a little over an hour and never subjected BF to an IME. She never had BF undergo any psychological testing. Dr. Cannon's testimony was merely variations of, from what they told me, for what she tells me. The lower courts were left with only defendants' subjective contentions as to whether a direct link exists between the 70-plus pound dog and equal opportunity. In that regard, it was extremely probative to the trial court that defendants adopted the dog because it didn't bark at the shelter and because BF had a big dog when she was a child, not because the dog would actually ameliorate her symptoms. BF living with multiple firearms while thinking about suicide was extremely probative to defendants' poor judgment and their limited self-awareness. BF lying in 2017 on her firearm purchase application was probative as to the lengths that defendants would and did ultimately go to get around obstacles and get what they wanted. In the end, each court applied the standard that everyone believed should have been applied. There was more than ample evidence to support the trial court's decision that the dog was not necessary. This court, in a case relevant to ours because it involved gun law violations, stated that, quote, deference to a trial court's fact findings is especially appropriate when the evidence is largely testimonial and involves questions of credibility. Thank you. Unless the court has any questions, which I'd be glad to answer, of course, I can go on to other points.
So we're here, of course, in a case, an appeal of right with a dissent. And we're here to try to provide some guidance and some principles that might apply in this area. So let's start with the definition of disability. Do you dispute that BF was disabled?
Well, the association is not appealing the appellate court's ruling in that regard. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Is that an issue before the court at this point, as you see it?
No, as I see it, the answer is no, because the appellate court made a ruling as to the disability, as to the definition of disability that was contrary to the trial court's definition, I believe. We've chosen not to appeal that, and I obviously the defendants wouldn't appeal that either.
And the second prong carries the data.
Yes, we think that is the issue in dispute. But, Your Honor, I don't think that the issue, I don't think the standard is in dispute, frankly. I think that the parties agree, as I tried to say in my preliminary statement, I think the parties agree that the second prong is that the animal has to be the precise accommodation, I should say, animal in this case.
No. I was referring to the second part of the definition.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Demonstrable medically or psychologically by accepted clinical or laboratory diagnostic techniques.
The association is not challenging the appellate court's position in that regard.
What must a party with a disability show to obtain a housing accommodation? Is it required that they demonstrate need or that the emotional support animal may be needed?
No, they have to actually show need. It has to be necessary. I mean, maybe necessary is...
So
don't the regulations say may be necessary?
Right, but I think we briefed that point, I think, adequately with showing that maybe is essentially is. Maybe, if maybe doesn't mean is or was, then maybe means anything. Essentially, by ruling that any resident is entitled to an animal that may be necessary to help the person, that essentially means that every housing provider in New Jersey must allow animals, which frankly, as a dog owner, I wouldn't be too upset about.
So your read of the term in the regulation may be necessary means you must come forward with concrete proof that it is in fact necessary. Not what the agency put forth in the regs, though.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, one more.
It doesn't appear to be what the agency said.
With your agency, you mean the Division of Civil Rights?
Yes.
Yeah, the Division of Civil Rights position is unfortunately problematic in that it's created a dynamic which has encouraged people to essentially go with, you know, it's better to say you're sorry than to ask permission. There has to be some standard involved with this process.
They've put forth the standard of maybe necessary. What does that tell us?
Well, that maybe necessary is essentially a prohibition against any rules and covenants that prohibit animals. Because I would simply take the position that I am I have a non-observable. The issue of observable disabilities is easier such as it is, the non-observable disabilities are more challenging because they require some probe into the veracity of the claim. But if all you have to do is say that an animal may be necessary, then there is no standard at all, because anything may be necessary.
So you're objecting to the standard as you say GCR implemented in its regulation, but that's also the federal standard that Congress chose to write into the statute, and it also says may be necessary to afford a person with a disability an equal opportunity to use and enjoy the dwelling. So you're also saying that Congress had it wrong and that no one should have written may be necessary?
No, not at all, Your Honor. In fact, I'm saying Congress and all the other courts have it right. May be necessary means is, as opposed to where it was years ago, which is means is now means maybe. Maybe means is. There has to be some standard. It can't be maybe. Maybe is a linguistic tool that a regulator would use to write a provision, but it's been interpreted as is. Otherwise, there is no standard.
What are you relying on for that? I'd
have to reference our brief, Sean, but we did brief that in our opposition to the amicus folks who put that forward. I also don't believe, I can answer your question more specifically if I look at it on rebuttal perhaps, but I also don't believe the defendants below made that argument. The defendants below, I think correctly, assumed that they had to show is. It has to actually be necessary.
When we talk about is and what's necessary, you seem to be saying that an accommodation can never be necessary unless it altogether makes the disability go away.
No, definitely not, Your Honor. I'm not saying that.
Okay. So then do you agree then that the standard is that it must alleviate at least one symptom of the disability? And alleviate, I do not mean make the symptom go away.
Alleviate.
I mean make the symptom better.
Mitigate, perhaps. Is the word. I think that's true. Look, I think as an attorney that practices in this area, I will say that I think for the most part, most requests are probably under the standard. I'm not going to use the policy situation of whether they should or should not be granted. I'm saying under the standard that I'm advocating, most requests would have to be granted, because most of the time you will have that nexus, especially with non-observable disabilities, as I said. Folks that are unfortunately blind or unfortunately in wheelchairs, for example, there isn't much back and forth this kind of thing.
Then why do you think, so in this case, you're saying that there was not sufficient evidence that the emotional support animal alleviated or mitigated, helped to make better at least one symptom of the disability?
Right, Your Honor, I am saying that. I'm saying this is one of those cases where the facts align with the position I'm taking. Most of the time they don't.
So we have some facts. We have some testimony from Dr. Kenner, but we also have a trial court finding, that trial court statement that, quote, BF demonstrated that this dog has acted to relieve certain symptoms of her mental health conditions, either by shortening or lessening them. Why shouldn't we accept and apply the deferential standard to a trial court finding that is due?
Because ultimately the judge ruled that the animal was not necessary. So it wasn't just simply...
But on this prong, we have a finding. Why shouldn't we rely upon that?
Because every dog has that effect on every person, unless they're cruel.
But here the trial court was very specific. After the chief read a portion, and then the trial court went on and said, the dog has allowed her to remain in the unit without her fiance or now husband, which she couldn't do before she had the dog. She said the dog sits next to her if she has an episode in the closet, which helps her to lessen or shorten the extent of the episode. And the court goes on. So why, as the chief said, if that's a factual finding, that it has mitigated, meaning made better, at least one symptom of the disability. She can be in the apartment alone. Her episodes in the closet don't last as long. And the trial court found that as a matter of fact. Even if the trial court was wrong on the law, why do we not have to defer to that factual finding?
Because BF's belief that she cannot stay in the house without the dog is not evidence, especially when the judge concluded that she lied on many occasions.
No, but I'm sorry.
She said, the judge did find that, I can't almost say her name, that BF testified that I can now stay in the home overnight because I have this dog.
But there is no other source for that kind of subjective analysis as to the ameliorative effects.
Sorry, Judge, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Go ahead. I just don't think there's no other source for that particular ameliorative effect.
The source would be an expert. She had an expert. The expert could have easily done some actual work and come to a conclusion that, in fact, BF was unable to, let's say, use the justice question about sort of mitigation and alleviation. The expert that they compensated could have testified to that effect through testing.
Like, I know you don't like Dr. Cannon. You've already poked holes at Dr. Cannon.
Personally, she might be very nice.
You were extremely critical of Dr. Cannon in your opening remarks.
Yes.
She testified that BF, quote, still suffered from bouts of depression and anxiety, but that those efforts were much less severe. So doesn't that support the trial court's factual finding?
No, she only testified, Mr. Chief Justice, that BF told her her systems were less severe. If that's the standard, then there is no standard at all.
All right, so what about the clinical social worker, Catherine Rim, who testified that BF's depressive episodes were, quote, more on the moderate to potentially severe scale, but, quote, after getting the dog, they seem to have decreased to mild to moderate. And then another quote, one of the ways that the dog was helping was having less times when BF would go into the closet, if at all. She definitely, even though she was still experiencing the depressive episodes, seemed to be more motivated, seemed to be able to better get herself going a bit better. So I would say that overall, it helped improve her ability to cope with day-to-day things.
Fair enough. That was evidence to suggest perhaps that the animal was necessary. But what about the other evidence that the judge also heard, which was after adoption, at least BF had at least the same amount of depressive episodes as pre-adoption times, including a two-month-long depressive episode. This took place after the adoption. How about the fact in 2019 she had 5 individual reports of suicidal thoughts? All the while, she has handguns and other weapons.
We discussed that it's not actually making the disability go away. It's just mitigating, meaning helping at least one of the symptoms.
But is it?
So there's testimony that it is.
One of the important things that our expert, Dr. Seeger, testified to was a concept called malingering, which transcends this context. It goes through all of our lives, which is when we want something, we're likely to report something in a way that will be more likely to get what we want. She is undoubtedly going to report that her life is better after she gets the dog. But yet when she goes in to speak with her mental health professionals, and we have the medical records, a different story was told. She is not actually better after she gets the dog. Most of these situations are troubling because most people, I mean, everyone who's mentally ill needs something. What the judge has to parse out here, though, is this dog any different from any other dog, any other animal that some of us may have? When we see it, we're happier. When we don't see it, we're not happy.
I'm confident that you advanced that argument before the trial court.
Yes.
That she is no better than she was before the dog. Did the trial court make that finding?
Well, it had to because it concluded the dog wasn't necessary.
Did the trial court make that express factual finding?
No, the trial court simply reiterated what BF testified to. And then in thereafter.
I don't know that that's accurate because the trial judge said the court does believe that BF .. what Justice Wainwright and I have read previously. So the trial court appears to have made that determination. And I was asking if your contrary argument is one the trial court also made.
But how could a trial court make a determinative finding that she was better in some ways? At the same time, the court also made findings that she committed perjury. I mean, at some point
on the LAD portion seemed to focus on the fact that the trial court did not believe that BF actually had a disability under the LAD. The trial court instead said BF suffered, quote, various forms of mental disturbances, but, quote, failed to prove that she was handicapped or disabled under the LAD because there was, quote, no aspect of her diagnosed conditions that prevented her from normal exercise of any bodily or mental functions.
Right.
You've agreed that that was incorrect, correct?
No, I'm simply saying that we've chosen that to be a hill not to die on. We advocated at trial, and I think we proved our case, at least to the trial judge, that this was not a legally cognizable disability for the purpose of LAD. I think I proved that under my impression, my interpretation of the statute. My client has chosen that that's not a hill that it wants to die on in this regard, because we don't believe that strategically it's likely to be reversed, and we also don't think it's necessary for us to prevail. The trial court, and Your Honor, I think his point is insightful in this regard, in that the trial court's views of what BF believed about herself, okay, was relevant in some ways to the trial court's decision that she wasn't actually disabled. See, so if the trial judge is taking the position that the conditions she has, and presumably still has, are not sufficient to create a disability for the purposes of LAD, then the judge's conclusions that somehow, that on some occasions, the dog makes her better are not dispositive. Because it's on one day, she might feel better. On the next day, she might not be better. So is that the standard? Is that the standard that all that a person has to do is claim that they feel better once they get something that they need? And that is the end of the discussion? Your Honor, it looks like you're about to ask a question.
It just seems like you're asking this court to establish a pretty high bar for determining whether the ESA may be necessary to afford a person with a disability the equal opportunity to use and enjoy a dwelling. In this circumstance, defendants already had the dog. In another circumstance, if this was a scenario in which the residents made an application to the association prior to getting a dog and marshaled support letters from Dr. Cannon and Rim, the social worker, saying exactly what those two individuals testified to, It seems like that would have been sufficient for an association to find that an ESA would have been a reasonable accommodation.
I think that actually goes to another point that I wanted to make. So I will say this. Those of us out in the field that deal with these things, on first glance, what I'm suggesting is the law and should be the law. Your honors have the right, you're going to set what you believe the right position is for this situation. It's a high bar. I think that's fair. I think the counter to that is the dynamic that has been set up with our laws. Okay. If a condominium in general loses, decides it doesn't like this letter, it doesn't like this, whatever, the bar has not been met. It's a big roll of the dice, because there's fee shifting, there's punitive damages. I can file a complaint with the government for free if I'm the aggrieved resident. The deck is stacked against the housing provider, perhaps properly, given the purpose of LAD, but the high bar is mitigated, no pun intended, I guess, by the fact that the housing provider must tread very, very lightly. Because if it is wrong, it's got a serious problem.
Does that suggest that the Attorney General's argument about having an interactive process before the decision is made is a sensible way to proceed? And even in the DCR advice about providing additional information upon request as part of this process?
Yes, Your Honor. That's a fair position, I think, for the Attorney General to take and for anybody to take. That would in some way mitigate, I guess, the high bar that Your Honor just mentioned. I think that's a reasonable approach. I will say, though, that I think we agree that there has to be a meaningful inquiry That's what I think the law should be, and I think we've done that. The interactive process is involved in the housing provider providing their information that they think should be relied upon. But in this case, the association did offer ADR. Your honors have seen the condominium cases with ADR and how it goes. You know, there are many of them that go to the appellate division, when ADR should be used and when it shouldn't be used. The association did offer that as an option, and the owner, KP in this case, was the owner at the time. He refused to participate in ADR. So in some regard, the court could find, if that were some issue in this particular situation, the condominium, in fact, did attempt to create Mr. Chief Justice, you said something about the collaborative process or deliberative process, that the condominium did attempt to do that, but was thwarted in its efforts because KP decided not to participate in that process. To go back to the point Your Honor made before about the burden, the high burden that we think should be in play. The first letter.
I'm sorry, just going back to the interactive process. I thought that the association had actually sent a letter to KP saying that it will not and cannot accommodate any alleged disability in regards to a dog that weighs in excess of 30 pounds. And then again, a few days later, that if a dog weighing more than 30 pounds that is either under your control or connected with you even enters the association will immediately commence an action at law seeking a court order barring any dog weighing more than 30 pounds. That does not seem like an interactive process.
What was the date, Your Honor?
It was an August 13th letter by counsel for the association to KP. And it was also an August 7th email from the association to KP. Mm-hmm. Neither one of those seem like an interactive process of saying, oh, I'm not sure that we have enough information. I think we need more information about this. Or, oh, I'm not sure if we can accommodate a 70-pound dog. What about a 65-pound dog? Instead, that says, if a dog weighing more than 30 pounds that is either under your control or connected with you even enters the association will immediately commence an action at law seeking a court order barring any dog weighing more than 30 pounds. How could that possibly be?
It's as I said in my preliminary statement, Your Honor, because KP lied to the association at the beginning. Before that all took place, KP told the association that my girlfriend is moving in with me. Even though a month earlier, she and KP had signed a form confirming that she was a permanent resident already of the unit, okay? So when someone comes to you and wants to begin this process and they lie to you at the beginning, what are you supposed to do?
When did you offer ADR?
ADR was offered on I think it was offered on, it might have been one of the letters that Your Honor read. It was early on. It was I think the August 13th letter, perhaps, from me. It was one of the letters I wrote, I believe. So I could find that and look at my rebuttal time. But the first, one of the very early communications, and the trial judge found this on August 8th, 2018, he lied to the association and told the association that she was moving in, even though she had just told us several weeks earlier that she was a permanent resident.
Can I ask a question about one of the statements that you've held up, and that relates to the firearm application? What relevance does that have? Does the fact that the questionable firearms application was, let's assume you're correct, answered falsely, does that undermine the expert conclusions about her medical and health condition?
I think what I'm saying is I'm not willing to concede that the medical health professionals concluded anything other than they were able to listen to what BF told them.
Your own doctor said, Dr. Siegert said she had bipolar 2 disorder.
Oh, you're talking about conditions, Your Honor.
Depressive disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, borderline personality type.
No.
Does her failure, let's assume that was not placed on the firearms application, does that undermine what the experts have testified to, including yours?
Well, no, not in relation to whether she is legally disabled. Her veracity and her filing a firearms purchase application that's false is relevant to the fact that she wants the court to then believe
pure credibility.
Pure credibility. She wants to come in and say, before I got this dog, I can't stay overnight at this apartment. Now I have it, I can. But at the same time, when I want to buy a firearm, I'm willing to lie about something.
And did the judge accept that argument?
We believe the judge did, which is why we won. which is why we want them necessary, because the trial judge did, in many parts of the opinion, make conclusions about honesty. And during the actual testimony, I don't know how deep the court got into the actual testimony, but the court said many times during the course of the actual testimony that BF had not been truthful. The judge said on the first day.
I raised it to begin with is I would think that to the extent you are arguing this firearms license should have been granted, that is in the province of a different agency. But you're making a broad-based credibility argument instead.
Oh, well, yes, I am.
Don't believe her because she must have lied there.
In a case where the subjective belief of BF is the end all and be all of this case, her willingness to lie on a firearms purchase application, okay, does show credibility as to what a person is prepared to do in order to get what they want. And anyone who owns a dog who is not cruel to the animal will probably tell you that there are lies they're prepared to tell in order to keep their dog. So when this court has to make a standard, the standard has to at least be, everybody's got to come into this in good faith, right? If the court's going to say, well, you know,
The trial court found that BF had acted in bad faith and had only been an incorrigible liar, then why would the trial court have said, the court does believe that BF has demonstrated that this dog has acted to relieve certain symptoms in the different portions that the Chief Justice and I already read, and then also made an equitable ruling. The trial court called it an equitable ruling that BF could keep the dog. So if the trial court found that BF had come with unclean hands, had acted in bad faith, was nothing but a liar, why would the trial court have found, even though the trial court was wrong on the law and the LAD and found that it wasn't relevant for LAD purposes, found for equitable purposes it was necessary, why would the trial court go out of their way to help BF with an equitable ruling if they thought that BF was nothing but as all you're saying?
Right, and that's why Judge Goomer dissented at the appellate division, because it was not logical for the court to make a ruling that BF had not proven that she was, that this animal was necessary under the law, and on the other hand, let it stay. And
whether or not you think that the trial court, I'm sorry, has the equitable authority to impose that, which I think is what the appellate division judge was disagreeing on, you agree that in order for the trial court to say that it was making this equitable ruling, it could not have thought that BF was only acting in bad faith, was only an incorrigible liar, etc.
Well, I mean, if you wanted the equitable decision to withstand scrutiny, yeah, you would have to say that. But if you just simply wanted the dog to stay because no one wants to ask someone to take a dog out of their home, then no. So my position is that if you consider all the evidence in the case, this judge was convinced, okay, that BF and KP were not honest from the very beginning and throughout the trial. I mean, they lied at the trial.
Well, what do we do with the court's finding that the trial court did believe that there was some relief of the effects of the disability? I mean, are you asking us?
No, that's fair. Your honors have to take the position that the standard should be proving necessary, and that the necessary has to involve something other than the subjective. I feel like I'm arguing the case before. The subjective belief that they are better. That the standard cannot be, I just have to tell you that I feel better because I have a dog.
But what if they give concrete examples, like I used to stay in the closet for 3 hours, and now with the dog licking my face, I'm able to come out of the closet in 10 minutes.
What if they do that after we were able to prove that they committed perjury and lied on other things? Then no, I think that's relevant to what the issue is.
Perjury is a pretty strong word. Has there been a finding of a criminal perjury?
Well, I guess I'm using hyperbole. Perhaps I shouldn't, but I'm confident the judge in the trial itself made findings about but during the course of she would interrupt witnesses and say, I don't know why you won't answer that question, or obviously that's not true. So that's why I'm saying those kinds of things. So perhaps the hyperbole is too much, but hopefully I've made my point in that when Your Honor wants to ask something. No, go ahead, because I keep seeing your hand up. So
it's okay. I didn't want to interrupt.
Look, I'm at a unit owners meeting. I know someone wants to talk. So go ahead.
So, I understand your point that she needed an expert to render expert opinions about the need for the dog to prove that the accommodation, quote, may be necessary. What does that expert need to do? Yeah. Recommend the emotional support dog, prescribe the emotional support dog? What sort of testimony would you anticipate would be sufficient in this case?
And that in a lot of ways goes to what Your Honor said earlier about the burden and where that should be. And that's a legitimate concern because regular folks just don't go out and hire experts to get accommodations. I mean, I don't think they do. At least they shouldn't have to. Certainly under the purposes of LAD, they shouldn't have to. So what would it be? It would be a doctor's note that has some kind of connection to the person. But it wouldn't be this, Your Honor. October 6th, the first thing that they sent to the condominium, the first official, medical type thing. To whom it may concern, I'm writing this letter in regard to, I'm going to leave her name out, who I have been treating since February of 2018. Okay, so that's 6 months. That's not too bad. I think that's fair. Blank suffers from a mood and anxiety disorder. I feel it would benefit Brittany, I said her name. I feel it would benefit BF to have an emotional support animal. Okay. It would benefit. That's not, she needs it to stay in the home or not sleep in the closet, or doesn't say she needs it to have equal use and enjoyment of the dwelling, right? It also doesn't say the 70 plus pound dog. It says animal. And the nuance here that we haven't talked about is that the condominium does allow dogs. They just don't allow dogs that are way more than 30 pounds. So when KP comes to them early on, okay, and I'll try to use less hyperbole, misrepresents the fact that the girlfriend is moving into the apartment. When the condominium already knows that she is a permanent resident, okay, it sets up the dynamic for the fact that he says, we are going to adopt a dog. Me and my girlfriend are considering, this is August 2nd, we are considering adopting an emotional support dog. So the condominium says, wait a minute, you don't have it yet. Okay, that's cool. So you don't need an emotional support dog. We don't need to know your medical history. We don't need to know your private matters. We don't need to know any of your business. You're entitled to your privacy. Just go get a dog that weighs less than 30 pounds. See what I'm saying? They didn't have the dog already. So the nuance here is that...
Sorry, are you saying that the law against discrimination does not apply if the person doesn't have the dog at the time that they move into the condo?
No, that's not what I said.
So then why does the housing association have the right to say, you don't have a dog yet, you must get one that's less than 30 pounds. That's our rule and we don't care about...
Because they don't need an accommodation if the dog is 25 pounds. Like, you don't need to ask me to give you an accommodation. I don't need to know your medical records. If you get a dog that's 25 pounds, they could have come back and said, we have our doctor says that we have to get a dog that's really big. That would be different, but they didn't. She comes back and she says that you need an animal.
Because you agree that if it's an emotional support animal, this your provision of the less than 30 pounds doesn't apply.
Oh, if they had an animal... And it weighed more than 30 pounds already, and it was therapy, then yes, then that would be irrelevant, right?
And wasn't that their position? They believed that this rule didn't apply to them because this was an emotional support animal.
Except, Your Honor, she went to the shelter and she adopted a dog because it didn't bark. And because it reminded her of a dog she had as a child. She didn't get the dog because it was going to ameliorate her symptoms. This may be a case that slides underneath a bunch of different bars vis-a-vis LAD and housing providers and emotional support animals. That may be the case. As I said earlier, I think for the most part, the way the setup is and the punishment that will be laid upon a housing provider, if it's wrong, for the most part, these are granted. In this case, though, the facts are different than perhaps what the court may want to set as a sort of overall kind of view. And so when KP says we are considering adopting a dog, what do we have to do to get an emotional support dog? The response is, you don't have to do anything. Just go get a dog that doesn't weigh 30 pounds.
That's not the rule.
it is the rule if they don't have a dog yet. If they would have come.
No, I'm sorry. The Attorney General's brief quoted from the HUD guidance, which makes exceptionally clear that the accommodation has to be provided regardless of whether or not.
I agree with that. What I'm saying is they didn't have the dog yet. So if they had the animal who was 60 pounds, then we wouldn't be having this debate.
But you agree that.
I agree.
But there isn't a store that you could just go to get an emotional support animal, right? It's something that the individual sort of bonds with in a way in order to figure out if it's something that can help them ameliorate the symptoms, right? There's not training. There's not necessarily specific guidelines for emotional support animals the way there are with seeing eye dogs, for example.
Correct.
Okay. So the fact that she liked the dog because it didn't bark or reminded her of another dog, I don't know how relevant that is when it's up to the individual to find some connection with that animal that would help and make them feel better.
It's relevant, Your Honor, only if you want to have a standard that's other than you get to have a dog if you say it makes you feel better. If the standard is, that's a fair debate to have.
And the second piece is that it doesn't affect the quiet enjoyment of other residents at the condo association.
That's the reasonable accommodation side. We think that's a reasonable accommodation piece, which we think comes after the fact. And we have no evidence. We didn't then, and we certainly wouldn't, even if I had it, I couldn't present it now. No evidence to suggest the dog is a nuisance or anything like that. So
you're not arguing that the dog was an undue burden on the condominium's association?
Never taken that position.
Or a fundamental alteration in the operations or anything like that?
The objective evidence here was that, that the dog... let's put it this way. My client testified, my board president, and he testified at my own instance. It was clear that the dog didn't, so in the reasonable accommodation piece, the dog simply would have to comply with the other rules, assuming the rules are not, they'd have to comply with the other rules, assuming they don't interfere with the accommodation, where they go to the bathroom, barking, things like that. I think we're on the same page with that. But we're not arguing that that's the question.
Mr. Byrne, I'm looking at the clock, and we're
okay. I'm done.
I wanted to know if you had any additional points you wanted to cover.
No, Your Honors. I mean, I don't know what else there's to say other than your questions were. Maybe walk through everything I want to cover.
But then,
and maybe on rebuttal, I'll have something.
We'll have you back for rebuttal.